In other places, September means autumn, but here in New Orleans, it's still the kind of weather that can drive you to drink. Drink gallons of sweet tea, of course. It's All Things New Orleans. I'm your host for the week, Eve Trow. This week, a love letter to sweet tea. And a guy who earned his community planning stripes after Katrina talks federal disaster policy and funding. As the Orleans Parish School Board prepares to take back oversight of all city public schools, we learn what the reunification plan looks like from education reporter Mallory Falk. But first, a story on millions of plants, crops, ruined by the floods. Governor John Bel Edwards is in Washington, D.C. again this week, and part of what he's asking for in flood relief would help farmers. It's harvest time for many of them, and the LSU Ag Center says the floods caused nearly $400 million worth of damage. WWNO's Tegan Wendland reported on this for NPR's Weekend Edition.
In the flatlands of south central Louisiana, just past Lafayette, big trucks drive fast down the country roads. Debris is piled high outside of farmhouses, hit hard by recent floods. It's where Christian Richard was born and raised. He even flaunts it on the plates of his big white truck.
A couple of us joke about it. It's called a ricense plate.
Just says rice.
It just says rice on it. Got a couple of grains on it. And it's part of who we are down here, and it's what we do.
He and his family have grown rice for six generations. He also plants soybeans and raises crawfish. He stands in what was a beautiful field of rice. Tall, golden heads blew in the breeze just a few weeks ago. Rice grows in water, but just a few inches, not several feet. The floods destroyed his crops, and when the sun came out, the stalks and their sprouted grains all dried up.
That's why you're getting this dry, crackly. It's an eerie sound in a rice field, you know, it's not something that you're used to experiencing.
He lost almost a quarter of his crop. This field took 2 feet of water, and he couldn't even get his truck back into it.
It's really disheartening when you get here 14 days after you think you're going to show up, and then it's all just flat on the ground, laying in the water, resprouted, and you have nothing to harvest.
The rain couldn't have hit at a worse time. Seasons come early in Louisiana, and farmers were just starting to harvest their rice and soybeans. Thousands of them lost crops. Richard is one of the lucky ones. He had crop insurance. Many don't. And right now, that's the only way they'll get help to replant and recoup their losses. State Agriculture Commissioner Mike Strain doesn't think it's enough.
No, not at this time. That's why we're going back to Washington.
Strain wants the U.S. Agriculture Secretary to make a disaster declaration for the rural farming parishes that got flooded. That would unlock some federal money and programs. But one problem is, the state doesn't know exactly how much was lost. Right now, it's $110 million and rising. Kurt Guidry calculated that number. He's an economist with Louisiana State University's Ag Center.
We can go and we can estimate and we can determine with pretty good accuracy how many houses were flooded, because once the damage is done, it's done, right?
But he says with agriculture, rain after the flood can cause almost as many problems as the flood itself. It's not the first time Guidry has been tasked with this job. This is the third major flood in Louisiana this year. And in a state with declining oil and gas revenue, agriculture is more important to the economy. Revenue has doubled over the past decade as more farmers get into soybeans and corn. But Strain worries that policy will have to catch up if current weather patterns continue.
How do you prepare for 24 inches of rain in 24 hours? Now, how do you do that? How can we minimize future flooding based on what we believe a weather pattern that could continue for a while? We know we're in a time of more intense weather patterns.
Though Richard's losses will be above $100,000, he can rely on his other crops to bring in some money. And if it floods again?
Oh, Lord. I don't know. This is an event that I hope to God we never experience again in our lifetime.
He will replant next year, and he'll take his toddler son out there on the tractor with him, hoping he chooses to follow in the family business. For NPR News, I'm Tegan Wendland in Lafayette, Louisiana.
Tegan Wendland, part of our coastal desk at WWNO, reporting on the floods for our region and the nation via NPR. Local, state, and federal officials are deep in assessment and planning mode after the Louisiana floods. New Orleans lawyer Jeffrey Thomas knows all too well what that's like. Since 2005, he's developed a unique practice helping organizations navigate the labyrinth of federal disaster funds. And he's already seeing places to help in this flood recovery. I started a long discussion, this is just some of it, by asking how he got this expertise.
I served as policy director in the city's Office of Recovery and Development after Katrina. I had been private practice after that. My background was always public policy, and I saw there was a need to give advice on how to receive federal dollars and streamline the process for using them. And a lot of that was delving into federal regulations because they're attached to every federal dollar you receive, and how you can both streamline the state and local governmental process to use those monies and alternately represent homeowners and businesses that are trying to receive some of those dollars for their own recovery.
And so where have you been able to apply some of that experience?
It's a growing industry, unfortunately. Ever since Katrina, really, you have more and more of a body of expertise around the use of FEMA and HUD money. It's not just law, but engineering, accounting, general consulting, project management. These are enormous processes, depending on the disaster, that'll last for years. And while the feds lay out in general frames, here's how you can get our money and use it, it's really left to state and local governments, who are reliably resource limited, to develop their own projects and programs to use that money efficiently. You can't have enough resident experts helping out that kind of process because, you know, all the while people are suffering, trying to be made whole again and try to figure out a way to be safer for the next time.
Here at WWNO, we've solicited responses from people who were impacted by Katrina and how they responded to the flooding in Baton Rouge and in other parts of Louisiana. And so many people drove many miles to cook. They volunteered things like doing laundry for people. So what's interesting is to talk to you then about how that same outpouring and that same instinct to help and respond is being extended not just by individuals, but by institutions. What do you see happening? Like, what do you know about what they're going through and what the road ahead is for them?
Right. So, you know, we're about 1 month past this great flood, and you're starting to come into that intersection between immediate disaster response and long-term recovery. And so at a state and local level, at the official level, you're really of two minds. You're still, in some cases, unfortunately, still cleaning up and dewatering and making sure basic provisions are provided for in terms of households that lost everything and may not have immediate alternative housing. So that's your most immediate concern. But more and more every day, you're starting to think about, how do I rebuild? What's available resource-wise for me to do so? Invariably, a disaster of this magnitude, you have to rely on federal dollars. And so suddenly you're asking yourself a lot of questions about FEMA and HUD in a way that you probably weren't the day before the disaster. There's a lot of in-house expertise in the state of Louisiana at the government level, which is a great thing because with each subsequent disaster, we're a little wiser for the wear, and that process can be streamlined as a result. Nonetheless, you're looking at really three pots of money. From FEMA, you have hazard mitigation grant money, you have public assistance money, and then from HUD, you have community development block grant money. Now, each of these are separate funding processes with their own slate of regulations and rules.
And you pointed out they don't all come in at the same time. The application process for them is all separate, and you don't know how much of any certain type you're necessarily going to get.
That's right. I mean, right now, you know, there's this fundamental ask to Congress, for example, because there is not enough money in the federal coffers to meet the need, right? So an estimated $8 billion in damages from this particular flood, there is not $8 billion that can be easily made available today in the federal among those federal agencies. And so Congress itself has to firstly act by allocating a sufficient amount of money to both HUD and FEMA that in turn then are made available per a variety of rules and processes.
You've also pointed out that it's challenging for a community to rebuild anything differently than how it did it the day before the storm. So say there's a library branch that flooded. The city says, well, you know, that library branch wasn't used so much anyway, you know, maybe they spent some time putting a plan together for that, and then what are the challenges to that smarter, better design moving forward with disaster assistance money?
So under current federal regs, if I want to do an exact duplicate, I'll get 90 cents on the dollar. if I want to consolidate libraries and or relocate them, you're going to get 70 cents of that 90 cents. Another, FEMA has done since learning lessons from Katrina, it does allow for what they call alternative procedures. So let's say you want to redo a whole system of libraries or streets, and you want to do them with a new design so that they're more floodproof, more energy efficient. You can enter into a settlement talks now with FEMA on the front end. You are starting to see a mandate that is requiring that the federal investment be protected by rebuilding things in a way that makes them less apt to be damaged from a subsequent disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be an interesting thing to see in the context of this flood and its recovery, how that translates into rebuilding decisions in these impacted communities, whether HUD will have that same requirement in Louisiana, and if so, how will that adjust expectations for the housing assistance that the state will be making available to individuals' homes?
It's pretty plain to see what the risk of delay is in coming up with these policies, in ramping up recovery efforts. And yet you also bring up the virtue of patience in this process of don't decide anything too fast, because what are the risks of making some decisions too quickly at the government level?
This is an unenviable position that any community is in when a disaster happens, and it's unavoidable that you have to at once try to figure out how to get back to normal as quickly as possible, but do so in a way that prevents this from happening again. And a lot of that's individual decision-making, homeowners asking themselves that question, what risk are they willing to accept? Then there's that line has to be drawn, when does the government mandate certain behaviors? It's a lot easier to just put out money and allow folks to rebuild as was without any requirements. There's enough bureaucratic entanglements that come with trying to give money to thousands of households. When you add layers of safeguarding, resilience-minded investments, it will complicate things. And yet, it's protecting that investment. It's not something you can turn a blind eye to, particularly in a state that has recurring disasters. And flooding will continue to happen. We're not quite at the point where there's a mandate. But I think what you're seeing more and more since Katrina, because more and more federal dollars are being spent every year for disasters, they are requiring more and more of these type of safeguards, these investments in resilience. And that's not something that will be waivable. There's a collision that's always happening with the use of this money. In one hand, you have this policy aim that's trying to rebuild these communities and make them whole and safer from future storms. The other force that's coming right at that is protecting taxpayer dollars from waste, fraud, and abuse. My big concern with this particular flood is how many folks didn't have flood insurance, and as a result, are all the more dependent on this federal money that might become available to them in the form of HUD money. And that's where you start seeing over time the diminishment of a community. When folks have to stay away from that home that was theirs for months and then years, you start losing the continuity, the stabilization of that community. These are small towns that have pride and identity and history, and it's an important moment.
Jeffrey Thomas, if I may call you disaster lawyer.
Yes, you may. I'm not a disaster myself, but I do know a thing or two about them. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to All Things New Orleans. I'm Eve Troe. Governor John Bel Edwards has ordered all 49 recovery school district charters transferred to the Orleans Parish School Board by 2019. New Orleans will then become the first city with a local school board overseeing mostly independent charter schools. Deirdre Johnson Burrell is a member of the Unification Advisory Committee that's helping guide this process. She spoke with WWNO's Mallory Falk.
What we've seen in New Orleans over the past 11 years is nothing like a traditional school district. And because the lion's share of our schools will continue to be charter schools, we really, as a city, have to chart out a course for what does it mean to have unified governance in a shared governance model. And what I mean by shared governance is our charters will continue to retain their charter autonomy as it relates to making site-based decisions, determining the start and end of school. school, how many days they have in a school year, the number of hours they have in a school day, and those sorts of hiring their personnel. However, we will have the opportunity, though, to look at a system-wide level and say, based on the needs of our students, what universal policies do we need in place that all players, all schools have to abide by? And that's what we'll get with this new system, with this return of schools.
Because charter operators are maintaining so much control and continuing to make the day-to-day operational decisions, some critics are saying that this is a return to local control in name only, that it's not actually going to lead to any meaningful change. What's your response to that?
Well, what I can say, I definitely understand people, you know, some folks' misgivings about we're operating in a different system. But I would beg to differ, actually, that this is just the same old, same old. This community now will have access at a policy level to the board it elects, and has a voice to be able to articulate what do we really need. Already there's different conversations being had about shared services. Like, what are the services that the district needs to provide to serve our most vulnerable students, whether that's our special needs students, whether it's our students who've been adjudicated, our homeless students? We are going to be able to address in a more precise and focused way the needs of our students and really determine what services need to exist at the system level. And I don't think that this is going to look like the old school system, nor do I actually think it's going to simply look like a continuation of the RSD. This is the birth of a unified school district.
One reason people pushed for unification was to bring schools back under a democratically elected school board. This is an election year, and given the reshifting of power back to the local school board, you might think a lot of candidates would be jumping into the race, debating the future of education in New Orleans. But that hasn't really been the case. 4 of the 7 school board seats are uncontested. 2 incumbents were automatically reelected. What do you make of the fact that there are so few candidates for school board?
That's a great question. I think at its core, our community really honestly is still trying to wrap its mind around, what does unification really mean? Is this really going to be significantly different than what we've seen before? Folks are asking that question. There isn't a model for what this looks like. So I think in a lot of ways, folks are still in our community are still wrapping their mind around, what does this all mean? And I think that that then plays itself into, okay, what will the role of the board be? But I think we get into this. This is going to be a very important election. This board is going to have to make some major decisions about the role that the district will play. And there's still a lot that is unwritten. This plane is being built while it's flying. So I think what's imperative is that the members of our community stay engaged, that they ask critical questions on how informed these candidates are. I think it's important, even where candidates are unchallenged or uncontested, that they should be engaging with community to make sure that folks really understand this, that they're garnering community sentiment. Because unification should be what it sounds like. Like, literally, what does it mean for our community to come back in under one tent and start to do the heavy lift of building an equitable and excellent school system?
What are some of the biggest decisions that school board members will be making in the coming years and that community members should really be engaged around?
I keep drilling on shared services because that's been a big issue. What shared services will the district provide? What will, you know, ultimately be the role of the district office? Transportation is being, you know, a big discussion. What will early childhood services look like? What will career education services look like? What will ELL, English Language Learner services look like at a citywide level? So there are a number of major policy issues that have to be worked out over the next 18 years. Actually, a little less than 18 months now. This is not sort of a done deal already. This is really our opportunity to build differently. And what do we believe in this city with the current student population that we have, with the level of poverty that we have, with the level of trauma? What needs to be provided to truly meet the needs of our students? And this is our chance to build going forward. We have the resources. We have a differentiated funding formula now. And our schools are under a board that we can hold accountable. Don't check out. Stay tuned in.
I've been speaking with Deirdre Johnson-Burrell, a member of the Unification Advisory Committee. Deirdre, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And reporter Mallory Falk will be following changes to OPSB as they happen. Dive into the little-known origins of a Southern staple, sweet tea. Producer Sean Powers of Georgia Public Broadcasting shared with us this tall glass of history. He talked with food journalist Tove Danovich and Vernell Mosley of the Sweet Tea Factory.
Sweet tea really has remained a regional specialty. You cannot walk into most restaurants, unless they're a Southern restaurant, and find sweet tea on menus. My name is Tove Danovich, and I'm a freelance journalist. The first time I ever tried sweet tea was visiting my stepfather's family down in Florida. Growing up mostly on the West Coast and in the Midwest, it was not something that I had at all been exposed to.
You've got a good eye for tea. You think I can have some of that Lipton?
Come aboard.
Well, that Lipton sure looks good.
Good? It's dandy tasting. Of the quality,
I think those brisk Lipton iced teas were around, which are super sweetened, and so I, you know, could get those out of vending machines here and there, but finding it as something on a restaurant menu was really baffling to me. Tea has been drunk in the United States since the very earliest days of colonization. You start kind of seeing the price of black tea go down around the World War I period of time, which is not to say that that war actually affected the price of tea.
America goes to war. Men of the Army, Navy, and Marines reinforce the battlefronts on six continents to save the homes and ideals of free men from Axis domination.
But World War II, because of the involvement of green tea, specifically producing countries, you had a trade barrier that allowed black tea to actually take over from green tea. Until World War II, green and black tea were drank about equally, in equal measures throughout the United States. After World War II, black tea became immensely more popular, simply because people had switched over to drinking it during the war when it was the only tea that was readily available. And since then, Americans have continued to drink primarily black tea. We don't know exactly where it began. I believe the first known published recipe for sweet tea, as we would think of it today, is in an old Virginia housewife's cookbook.
After scalding the teapot, put into it 1 quart of boiling water and 2 teaspoonsful green tea. If wanted for supper, do this at breakfast. At dinner time, strain without stirring through a tea strainer into a pitcher.
But that isn't to say that people in other states weren't drinking sweet tea. And, you know, there may even be a small cookbook, self-published recipes traded back and forth that we have no ability to have records of today.
A squeeze of lemon will make this delicious and healthful, as it will correct the astringent tendency.
My name is Vernell Mosley, and I am a tea purveyor of Sweet Tea Factory. When I first started learning about tea, the fact that all tea comes from one plant blew me away.
When I take my sugar to tea, all the boys are jealous of me.
cause I never take where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea.
Here it is. André Michaux, he was a French explorer and botanist. And in the mid-1700s to early 1800s, he was noted for actually importing the actual tea plant here and planting it in Somerville, South Carolina. There was some discrepancy about what was the first tea estate, whether it was the Bigelow Estate in Charleston or this particular estate in Somerville. Then we'll take credit for, you know, being the pioneer or the one who made the, you know, wonderful discovery of tea in the U.S.
Cause I never take where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea.
One of the members of the House of Representatives, as a joke, created a bill that said if you're a restaurant serving unsweet tea, you must serve sweet tea. You cannot just serve unsweet tea. And he wanted to make it law for the city of Atlanta. And I thought it was a great thing. That's because I'm biased. I'm a tea purveyor, so of course I'd want everyone to serve tea as well as sweet tea.
Every Sunday afternoon, we forget about our cares.
I'm Tyler Hobbs, and I'm from Indiana. I drank sweet tea growing up. My mom actually would brew it in the sun. She'd brew it in a big pitcher and set it out in the sun all day long.
Barbara Brockway, Atlanta. I'm a Yankee, so I never drank sweet tea. Growing up, I drink unsweet tea, still do.
Calvin Williamson, Atlanta, Georgia. I like sweet tea because it was something that I've always drank from early childhood on up to now. It's just, if you're born in the South, it's just what you drink. And the sweeter, the better. I mean, if you run out of syrup, you can pour it over your pancakes.
Rubbing elbows at the Ritz with those millionaires. When I take my sugar to tea, I'm as ritzy as I can be. For I never take where the gang goes when I take my sugar. When I take my sugar to tea.
That's it for this sweet edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Eve Tro. Thanks for listening, and catch you next week. Here on 89.9 WWNO, 90.5 KTLN Thibodeau Houma, broadcasting from the University of New Orleans and online anytime, wwno.org.